This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 354th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's Awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the most talented young actresses in Hollywood. She's only 26, but she has already won two Emmys for Best Supporting Actress in a Drama Series, on top of nominations for Critics' Choice and Screen Actors Guild Awards, for her portrayal of fiery Ruth Langmore, a smart, angry, and ambitious young woman caught between the crime family into which she was born and the one with which she does business, on Netflix's hit show Ozark, which started streaming in 2017 and will end with a supersized fourth season once the pandemic is over. And she has also been winning raves for her portrayal of Quiet Jane, an assistant to an abusive Harvey Weinstein-like movie mogul, in Kitty Green's indie film The Assistant, which premiered at the 2019 Telluride Film Festival, screened again at the 2020 Sundance Film Festival, is now streaming on Hulu, and is eligible for recognition in this unusual 2020-2021 Oscar race. Julia Garner. Over the course of our conversation, the actress reflected on the personal challenges that led her to try acting in the first place, how she came to embrace the fact that she has generally been offered quirky or wacky characters as opposed to girls next door and love interests, how she approached the two completely different characters of Ruth on Ozark and Jane in The Assistant, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Julia, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Great to see you, and congratulations on, what has it been, like a week since the Emmy? I think exactly.
Yeah, thank you so much for that lovely introduction. But yes, it has been a week, which feels weird because I'm actually in the middle of shooting right now something else. So, you know, it. One hand, it's one of those things that it feels like a lifetime, but it also feels like yesterday. And actually, yes. It feels honestly so surreal that it doesn't feel real quite yet.
Well, two in a row, not bad. And I guess we're, you know, certainly going to come to what you got that for. But in the meantime, we just always begin on this podcast really truly at the beginning. Can you share with our listeners, where were you born and raised, and what did your parents do for a living?
I was born and raised in New York, Riverdale, New York, which is kind of like a suburb in the Bronx, but you still got the number one train down the hill, so you got a little bit of best of both worlds. And then my dad is a painter and art teacher, and my mother is used to be on the Israeli SNL like 30 something years ago and turned therapist. Wonder why I'm an actor. Now you know.
Well, I thought that was so cool when I was prepping and I read about the fact that, so is she Israeli?
Yeah. I mean, and the fact that I grew up in New York, it's like, of course, like, what else was I gonna do? And then my sister's also, she's also a teacher, but she's also hilarious, and she's a very good writer, and I'm definitely, from out of my family, I'm definitely the more boring one. For sure. You can ask anyone that works with me that meets them, they're like, oh my God.
Well, I guess... It's true, I think, that you guys kind of, one of the ways you all bonded was similar to my family, old movies, right? Can you share, I guess that was even more than current movies, a part of your growing up
Yeah, I'm getting a New York vibe from. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Connecticut. It's pretty close.
But I mean, same thing. It's like
Yankees fan.
Yes, yes, I am.
Good, good, good.
Where in Connecticut? Right, I went to school in Connecticut.
Wait.
Yeah, I'm from New Haven, suburb called Woodbridge. Where were you in Connecticut?
I went to school in Greenwich.
Yeah,
Connecticut. Yeah. So awesome. I mean, yeah,
small world.
So small. Yeah, I had a lot of friends in New Haven. What was the question again? I apologize.
No, yeah,
it's always
all good,
weird when I'm like talking about myself only. So I'm just being honest.
No, thank you. It's all good. It's it was just about how old movies were. I guess TCM. You probably are one of the first, you know, and me, to grow up with TCM. It was a resource that most prior generations didn't have.
I know. I grew up watching Turner Classic Movies. My parents love film. I mean, they're artists and, not only artists, but just teachers and they love explaining things as well. So I definitely watched films that were questionable to showing, like a 10-year-old, like, you know, Rose, like All About Eve and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which is kind of scary for like a kid, but I'm super happy that I watched it. And, you know, I was familiar with Bette Davis and Clark Gable and, you know, all those old time Hollywood stars, but then also just like 70s cinema too. But when I was a kid, like they weren't showing, which is so weird to me, they were not showing 70s cinema on Turner Classic Movies. Like now you go open it and they're showing like Pretty in Pink, which to me is like, you know, and I wasn't even born at the time, but that's more of like a newer movie than like His Girl Friday or something, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. And then I guess you were into this, you know, older movies, but that's not why you pursued. It wasn't like, all right, I want to be Bette Davis. The reason you first.
No one can be Bette Davis. First
that
of
was,
all.
That's true.
Yeah. There will only be one Bette Davis.
That is definitely true. But I guess the thing, though, you know, you've talked about in other interviews, it was really more about being a shy kid, needing to come out of your shell. But I think one of the things I'd like to get into more, if we can, is just, you know, what made you so shy? What was the reason that you were drawn to acting to try to overcome that?
Well, yeah, you know, there's a whole reason behind it, which is, I think that was also one of the reasons why I loved film and television, was that was really the way that I learned a lot of things. Because I'm a visual person, I had reading problems. I struggled from terrible dyslexia and auditory processing, and I had to experience it rather than, you know, tell me how to play a game. I had to like experience the game and then kind of play it, which makes sense why I love acting,
yeah,
which is experiences,
yeah,
and hands-on learning. So there was that. And I just felt, you know, even when I finally learned how to read, there was a part of me that felt dumb and insignificant and just, you know, not reading, you know, learning how to read at the age of 10 does something to your confidence, you know, and that's still something that I struggle with. You know, I still feel at a lot of times insignificant or dumb, you know, because, you know, I feel like things that happen to you as a child, traumatic, don't go. It shapes who you are, you know, and it shapes who you are as a person and how you view yourself, good, bad, it just shapes you. But that's also, that being said, that's how I also approach characters too and the people that I play, because, you know, I try to find, the first thing that I try to figure out internally when I'm doing the self-work is, who were they when they were kids? Like, what is something that triggers them, that brings out their insecurities and their neuroses, and what is that thing that defines them to their core in a way? And that
so
always happens,
yeah,
when you're a child. You know, there is a certain age that you're like stuck in, you know, because that certain event happened in your life where you lost your innocence in a way, mm-hmm, and you kind of view the world differently. So that's what I always try to find, that like, who is, what is that inner child with the character, you know? So it actually affected my acting in a very deep way that I learned later. Yeah, it's the good, the bad, it's everything.
Yeah. Now, whose idea was it to try to, you know, use acting to overcome this, and specifically to go, I think it's T. Schreiber Studio. That was the place where, how do you end up there? What was the route?
Well, you know, I needed to do some activity on Saturday afternoon class, you know, because you should always keep teenagers busy, no matter what it is, you know, no matter how great the kid is, you don't know, they might hang out with the bat, you need to keep them busy. But I think, you know, my sister took act, and I actually think even if you don't end up acting, I think taking an acting class is very beneficial for people in a way, with taking you out of your comfort zone. So mm-hmm. I did that to overcome my shyness, and because I was so uncomfortable with the words that I was saying, because I felt like I couldn't articulate myself, that I had an easier, and I still very much so have an easier time saying other people's words in a way. So that's probably, and I just like the feeling of forgetting who I was mm-hmm. temporarily, and then them calling, okay, done, cut, you know. But my first acting teacher was, he recently passed away. He's amazing. It was Peter Miner. And then I did a summer program at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts when I was like 14 with a wonderful, she's still my acting coach, Pamela Scott. And I still, again, because I did not go to a conservatory for 4 years. So I had to, and I didn't act since I was 2 years old. So I had to catch up quick, you know.
Well, I thought it was really interesting that even after you got Ozark and, you know, people would, they're, you know, you're winning awards and all this stuff, that you still really have this close working relationship with Pam. What is it specifically that she can even do for you at this point of life? That, you know, what is it more like just a matter of kind of comfort having, knowing that you can pick her brain, or is there something specific that you guys do?
Oh, no, I don't think you can get too comfortable ever being an actor. That's what it is. You know, I think that you always, as soon as you do feel that comfort in a way, I mean, for sure, I'm definitely more confident than I was and I'm learning more, but you don't want to get it too much in your head, because then you have no room to even grow even more. You know, I think it's more that I don't want to on the day, like if I'm starting to work on the day on set, I don't want to have to learn new things about my character when I'm on set. I think the key to the difference between good acting and great acting is that you know that person that you're going to play and that you're going to be for however long, that you know it inside and out, that it's not just knowing the lines and hitting your mark, that you really, really got to know this person. And I think that's so beautiful, like actually knowing, meeting someone new, you know?
Was it through that kind of relationship with an acting coach that you came up with what I believe is really a big part of what you do for prep in terms of journaling as a character? Or is that was that something you just hit upon independently?
No, I mean, for sure, I learned, you know, you have to learn, like, you know, a new actress isn't going to know, especially like a 16-year-old actress isn't going to be like, I need to know this part in my bones. Like, you're still a 16-year-old. You know, you need somebody to say like, hey, listen, like, if you want to act with the best actors, like, you need to know the character inside and out in your bones, you know? So, yeah, for sure. It definitely helped me to journal and to do the internal work. Pam helped me with that. But I want to make sure that I'm always prepared for anything, you know, and acting is not, I mean, you still have the best actors. I think Al Pacino still worked with his acting coach, and Laura Dern still worked with her acting coach. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I read. I don't want to have false information, but you know, it doesn't, and they're like the best. I mean, it doesn't stop, you know?
Yeah.
You can't stop learning.
So what made you say, I guess, about a year into being, I think, at Triber Studio that, you know what, I'm not only enjoying this, but I think maybe I should start auditioning for professional gigs. Were you getting particularly good feedback about your work, or was it just, let's see what can happen? What was the thought process?
Well, I don't want to be like, I don't want to like be like, wow, I'm this. But I was very lucky. I've always gotten good feedback. So, but that's not enough, you know. But I started doing a lot of short films for Columbia Film School. And that was kind of like, I kind of not saw what a set was like, but kind of got experience from that and learned from that a little bit. And then, you know, I think this was the thing that I was lucky. I was, there was an open casting call for this TV show called Skins that, this, student filmmaker's girlfriend was interning at a casting office, Susan Shopmaker. And I got a Facebook message like the night before, when I still had a Facebook, that like there was a night before, like, oh, there's an open casting call for this English show that's going to be brought in America. Like, just come by. And there was 1,500 kids just in New York. They were also looking in Canada and LA. And it ended up being me. It was a crazy audition process, open casting call, which they don't have those anymore. And it ended up being me and another girl. I thought after that, I thought every audition was going to be like that, which it's not like an open casting call at all. And I was so devastated when I didn't get it because that was my first professional audition. And that casting director, Susan Shotmaker, called my mother and she said, I'm going to find this girl a manager. She's going to work. Don't worry. And she did find me a manager. And that manager ended up leaving the business, but I was also lucky that he suggested another manager, and I'm actually still with my manager today.
That's right.
So, and then a few months later, she cast Martha Marcy May Marlene. So that was my first movie.
I very much remember seeing that on the festival circuit. And I think just for listeners who haven't yet caught up with it, it's basically sort of a group of young women who are being indoctrinated, I guess, into a cult might be a way of putting it. I don't know. Had Sean Durkin, the director, and I think the writer, he'd never made a feature.
That was his first. He was like, I mean, everybody was such a baby on that set. Like everybody was like, I think they like just finished film school or like barely finished. Like it was one of those things, and it was like summer camp. And I was 16. So the thing that I learned on that set was how to be on a set. You know, I didn't even know what a script supervisor was. Like I was, you know, and this was like 2010. So when I went to Sundance, like Sundance was very cool amongst like film people, but it still wasn't super like commercial. It was, yeah. So I kind of was just going with the flow. Like I just was like, oh, yeah, this is the festival that, you know, Robert Redford started, I guess, So, yeah.
And the movie, you know, really was a critic's darling and got a lot of good feedback. And I guess I would imagine that for you, that really sort of led to a maybe greater number of auditions or opportunities or whatever. And I wanted to pause there to ask you about something that you've said in other interviews where you talk about the fact that from very early on, maybe from that point, you realized that there were certain kinds of parts that people were inclined to think of you for and certain kinds that they weren't. And I wonder just how do you figure out what people are gravitating to you for or aren't? And how does that, is that a weird thing to even know or, you know, just processing that?
I think the thing was that I didn't move to LA right away.
Because
as much as I love LA, but I think a lot of times before Ozark, a lot of people in LA didn't quite, they were like, she's great, but there was always a but. And it was like, she's great, but maybe she like needs to straighten her hair and like get veneers, you know? like there was, you know, they just couldn't accept the fact that like, I guess I had a gap tooth and like really curly weird blonde hair. They just didn't quite get it, which is fine. It worked out for me in my bed, but it was a curse and a blessing at the same time. But I kind of knew, I was like, you know, I need to get something that will be kind of weird and not quirky, but just kind of bizarre and like not like girl next door. But then also gets from that, because it's universal and everyone likes it, that it gets kind of a commercial aspect of it too in the end. And that ended up being Ozark. You know, we didn't know where the show was going. You know, obviously Jason was, this was kind of his passion, all that thing. And that's kind of what it was. And now all of a sudden people are like, oh my God, Julie. I'm like, you didn't like me. Like, not like me, but you didn't cast me. Like, you know, like I can't, like when people are like, how come you never did these kind of parts and those typical, those like girl next door parts? I'm like, because no one ever cast me. Like, for them, like, I probably auditioned to play someone's kid, but they didn't cast me, you know? So,
well, let's talk about some of these parts that were between Martha Marcy and Ozark, because as you say, they tended to be maybe eccentric or outsider or whatever.
Yeah. It's okay. You don't have to sugarcoat it.
No. Well, let's start with a religious Mormon who believes she's impregnated by a song in Electric Children. This was your, I guess, most sizable part up to that point.
Which is funny, because when we were shooting that, I was in Utah and I was like, I'm pretty sure I'm the only Jew in Utah. So it's fine. But yeah, from New York.
Yeah. Well, I guess, and that one almost didn't happen. It was sort of a last minute thing, right?
Yeah, it was I mean, talk about amazing student film. It was, you know, our director, Rebecca Thomas, was who, you know, I love. And she was just graduated. I believe it was like her thesis in a way, which wow. Talk about like an amazing thesis. But yeah, that was, you know, another thing that I was super happy about after Martha, you know, I auditioned for leads and big things and all those things, but I subconsciously didn't really want to book them because I knew that I wouldn't be ready to like carry a movie. And there was a point where I was in a few things and I remember thinking like, I'm ready to do a lead and I want to do that, but it has to be the right thing. And I think that was definitely the right thing. You know, it wasn't this big Hollywood budget type, like you have to be ready for that, you know, because it's a carrying movies like it's a very big responsibility. It's you just have to also know how to break down a script too properly.
Do you remember any of the bigger movies that you went out for but didn't end up getting at that time?
Oh my God, there were so I can't tell you how many auditions I went. I was talking about my sister. I was like, remember I used to go on like 3 auditions a week. Oh God. I feel like it all worked out, you know. I'm so happy with how my career has been going. You know, I wouldn't change it, you know.
Totally.
I'd rather do it slowly and steady than just rush. So, but yeah, but Electric Children was, I learned so much from that film. You know, and I learned so much from all the films that I do.
Well, so that was Martha Marcy's 2011, Electric Children's 2012. Also 2012 are two others that I just want to mention. I know they were smaller parts, but it's, you know, I guess Perks being Wallflower. Oh, yeah, exactly. And Perks probably on a, I would guess budget wise, was probably bigger than anything to that point.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I was a featured extra on that.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, for sure. And it was very exciting to be on like a super big set, you know. But that being said, like I started my start on it, doing indie films, you know, and that's honestly why I wanted to also, if we're talking about the assistant as well, like that's why I wanted to do, I remember between Ozark and I was doing Dirty John and Ozark, as much as they're all great TV shows, I remember telling my agent, like, I want to do something where I'm going back to my roots, which is a smaller independent film, you know, with a powerful story. So
yeah,
and I was lucky. I got the assistant.
Definitely. Which I'm going to focus on more than some of these, but I do want to mention, I read that David Chase specifically wrote the scene in Not Fade Away that you appear in. How does that come about?
Oh, man. Well, that I will tell you some other crazy extra stories about that. So I auditioned for the daughter in that, and I didn't get it. Again, I always audition. I'm like, she doesn't look. She's a weird looking. So they auditioned. So he wrote me as some like weird ghost dreams. Of course, he wrote a weird ghost dream sequence. You know, that's the part that I'm going to get. So so I got that, and that was actually my first trip to L.A. Oh, God, I can't believe I haven't. This is the first time I'm telling the story, like, publicly. And on the plane, I was, like, so excited. It's the first time I, like, flew, like, first class or whatever. And it was just, like, so exciting for me. And, you know, I was with my mom, and actually my acting coach came because I was so nervous. And that week, they shoved so many meetings. They shoved, like, 3 or 4 meetings a day. And at the time, I didn't know how to say no, so I was just kind of stretching myself super thin. And on the plane, I got off the plane and I got this horrible eye infection, like green. And it wasn't contagious because I had a doctor come. And I was having, I'm telling you, when I had some, I'm like, how, where are these meetings? Like, I had like a chemistry reading with Claire Danes like the next day. And then I had like all these meetings. I had a meeting with, was it Fred Roos from the guy who like produced that guy? I'm sure he doesn't even remember me, but I had green pus coming out of my eye, and
oh my God!
And then I just like I had to apologize to everyone like beforehand that it's not contained. I should have just worn an eye patch at that point because. And I was honestly, since then, I was like, LA is not the place for me. I have the worst luck. I got an eye infection. Luckily, they put heavy, like almost clown makeup in the David Chase thing, so you didn't get distracted from the eye. So yeah, that was
now we have
first,
to go look and try and see it.
Yeah, that was my first trip to LA.
Oh my God. Yeah, that would be
like,
tough.
That's not a part of the question, but I just had to put that out there.
No, I think that's as you say, you're like your first time. You gotta, and you're probably worrying about making impressions and all that. And
oh yeah, and I forgot this. And then I had a chemistry with such a big read, and I had to apologize for my eye was like for there at the time I didn't know it was for the Masters for the Paul Thomas Anderson thing.
Oh.
And you know, and I didn't work. I mean, I I was sitting, like, I had to apologize for my eye to, like, everyone. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I love Paul Thomas Anderson. He's, like, my favorite. You know, it's just kind of, but, you know, whatever.
It yeah. worked out.
He's, maybe he'll remember me as, yeah, that eye girl. So, you know.
Well, okay. So that brings us to 2013. One of two Cannibal Sisters. In We Are What We Are, a remake of a Mexican horror film. I would think that's another not girl next door part. I guess let's pause there for a second. Anything took away from that?
First of all, I love that director, Jim Mickle. He is one of the best directors I've ever worked. He's just also the best guy, you know, and he's such a great director. I love all the directions that he's just, I can't, you know. I can't speak more any highly of him because he's just so amazing. But yeah, I would suggest every actor should do a horror film at least once in their life because it is the hardest thing to shoot because you have to pretend extreme scenarios that would never happen. You have to like believe that and act, but it's really hard and you have to scream all the time and you have to cry. So it's like really intense, but that shoot was so much fun and that whole production was so great. And that's what I learned was I was so happy to do a horror film because I learned a lot.
Interesting. Well, I think the first time you did a film that would have required kind of working totally with your imagination, really, in a sense, with just green screens, that would be Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. That's 2014. Do you like that where it's essentially just in your head what you're doing, what you're acting opposite, or is that challenging?
I mean, honestly, it feels like an audition. It feels like you're in a casting office, you know, and that's even harder because you don't even have the part.
Right.
You know, so it's like, well, I'm doing all this work and, you know, I might not even get it. So, but this, it's like, okay, well, I'm at least, you know, and at least there's props. At least you have with auditioning, you don't have anything. You have to use your script as a prop, I guess. You got to just use what you know, and if you do come in with props, you look like some weird, like, artsy fartsy actor or something. When people are like, oh my God, this guy or this girl, like, but yeah, that's what I just learned, you know, I learned that you have to just kind of depend on it. The work speaks for itself. You know, you don't want to depend on anything. Like, you don't want to be one of those actors that are like, yeah, the scene's going to be great. You know, we're going to add some great music. Because the music, you don't know, you know. Once the movie's done, it's out of your control.
Right. I think the first time I was really consciously aware of, like, okay, so who is this actress? I need to look her up and find out. And obviously I'd seen Martha Marcy and other stuff, but the first time you really registered. Yeah, this would be Grandma, which was another Sundance movie. You're playing a pregnant teen who asks her grandma for help in obtaining an abortion. Your grandma is played by Lily Tomlin. And I would imagine, as you've talked about, you know, being somebody who was familiar with movies from before your time, that she might have been somebody who was already on your radar. And I just wonder how that works when it's the two of you and she's a legendary person. Is that intimidating?
Or how do you come?
Super iconic. No, I mean, again, I was super young. So I think one hand, yes, I knew all like the movies and the famous movies that she was in, but you're kind of like, when you're like a teenager or like even like 19, 20 years old, you're kind of just like go, go, go. And you don't really process things. So like one hand, yes, but the other hand, no. But the thing that I saw, look, her stamina is like next level. And that is a big part of this business and any business really, is stamina. And just, yeah, how... Yeah, her stamina is incredible, and she's just so fun. Like, she makes really a light set, and that's one thing that I've learned over the years, that you don't know where the project's going to go. It might go somewhere, it might not go somewhere, but at least make the set fun and nice and light, because the project might not go anywhere, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think it would have been roughly around that time that you started what ended up being a recurring role from seasons 3 through 6 on one of the TV shows that's, you know, considered one of the greatest ever, not just of recent years, and that is The Americans. You were playing the CIA agent's daughter who gets romantically involved with this KGB spy. And by the time you joined that show, I think it was already held in really high regard. I've talked to other actors who say that in some ways it's really particularly intimidating to join a show when it's already up and running and everybody knows each other and they have particularly acclaim at like this one did at that point. How did you adapt to joining a series for, I think, the first time?
For sure it's intimidating, but I think I'm going to go back on what I was saying earlier about you're instantly in ease when you know that person and you know that character inside and out. All of that fear goes out the window and you're just focusing on that person and what you want to translate on screen, you know? So I think that is just a good insight for any actor, is just focus on your work and focus on getting to really know the person that you're going to play. So then you just can become that person. But what I learned on that was, you know, was how TV works. TV is very different how it's shot than film. It's much more difficult. Everything's moving much more fast. Everything's more last minute. I mean, and that wasn't even such a last minute show compared to like a lot of other shows, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think also that was probably like my second TV audition, like ever, or third or something, like was very early on. I was very reluctant to do TV for like a long time.
How come?
Well, because for a long time, things were like movies, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like TV, you know, you had Oz being like the first of its kind. And then after that, you had The Sopranos, and then you had The Wire and Breaking Bad and Dexter. And those were like, I don't want to say it, but those were like the big, big ones, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I don't know what year it changed, but there was something that shifted, and now it's kind of the golden age of television. Mm-hmm. And I kind of was seeing that, for whatever reason, I don't know how, but I kind of saw that. I was like, something's happening with movie scripts, and they're not what they were even 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, you know, I'm kind of interested, like, what are TV scripts like right now? And there was a part of me that I was like, I think I need a, and I wanted, you know, obviously more, but I felt like I was like, I don't have a name really. And I feel like you get the name from television, but I want it to be a good television show. I don't want to just get a name for something bad, you know? Right. But yeah, again, like, that's not a bad thing to think, because you need a, actors need an audience, you know? So when mm-hmm. I'm saying name, like, you, that's, I have to, I can't just write or paint by myself. Like, acting requires an audience. So.
Well, and I guess it would have maybe overlapped that during those, you know, that period of 2015 to 2018, when you were popping up in 10 different episodes of The Americans, it must have been at that, in that, within that period that you first heard about Ozark, right?
Yeah. So I was doing The Americans, and then in between that hiatus, I was trying to find the right job, and I wasn't getting like a job right away, to be honest. Again, it's a very unsteady career. And I just was like, I'm going to get something great. But then I was like, am I? Then I started really like, oh God, no. But I was like, I'm going to get something great. I know I will. And then Ozark came in. And that whole thing was so fast, because Ruth wasn't in the pilot. You know, she only popped up in episode 2 for a second. But I didn't know that at the time. Mm-hmm. And they gave us the pilot, and then they gave me a mock scene. And I did a movie a year before with a Missouri accent, and I saw that it said Missouri, and I was like, oh, there's an accent. I immediately assumed that there was an accent. Mm-hmm. And I also was like, oh, well, she's probably, you know, more likely to have an accent because she's, you know, uneducated and, you know, all those, she's probably, mm-hmm. you know, didn't go to school as much, and, you know, all those things. And, mm-hmm. And then when I prepared for it, I only prepared for it with an accent. And then when I got to the audition, you know, New York casting offices are so small, and they're like, the walls are paper thin, and you can hear who's going to do the scene and your scene. And then you could sometimes hear like, that was great. That was the best. And then you're going like right away in, and you're like, oh my God. And then, so everybody was having just a normal accent, and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be like that crazy actor that's like, better hire me. I'm really going in for this part. You know, like, I'm method on this. And they're like, this person's nutcase. Like, so I was like, and I was like, oh my God, I don't want to be that crazy actor. I was like, let me try doing it the regular accent. I couldn't remember a single line in the regular accent. And I went in, and I was like, just, I'll do it with the accent that I prepared. And I did it once. I called my mom. I was like, I'm not getting this part. Forget about it. And I was devastated, because I really knew that this was a great part, and I was going to have a hard, I never get like this. I was going to have a hard time seeing someone else do that part, because I'm very good at moving on.
Just interrupt for one sec, because so you say you knew it was a great part in a good show, but what do you remember, what scene you performed that made you feel that the character was going to be good?
It was a mock scene, and the mock scene was something that Wyatt was, ruined someone's car, and it was going to jeopardize, like, it was going to affect him and his college application, and all, just typical, sounds like Ruth thing, like, why, you know? But I really loved how, I just loved how deep it was. Like, there's something so sad about her wanting a better life. She knew that maybe she couldn't do it, but she knew the potential for another one of her family members, and she wanted a better life for them in a way. And there was something so hopeful, weirdly hopeful about her, that like, I was like, this is a girl who gets up in the morning, every morning, with a purpose, you know? And I saw that right away. And she's just so curious. And that is such an important quality to me in just with people is curiosity. Because you can even have someone who's well-educated and they're not curious and there's only so deep that they can go. But if they are, they go very deep.
Mm-hmm. So you leave the audition, you call home, this bombed, and then what?
And then I got called back next week. And I guess the accent thing worked because that's a... And it worked out because, you know, you could tell the difference between the two families, the Langmoors and the Byrds, you know? It kind of everything... I'm a very big believer that everything happens for a reason, you know?
And at some point, somebody... I don't remember if it was the showrunner or who it was, but I gather that somebody was like, after you left the room, I don't know if it was the callback or the original, they're like, oh, we're going to have to make this character a bigger part of the show. You've heard that as well?
I mean, I don't want to be like, yes, but yeah. I guess that's what I, yes.
No, that's great. It's
great. I feel very, you know, but again, everything happens for a reason. And I just really love Ruth, you know, her good, bad qualities, everything.
So had you ever really spent a significant amount of time away from home, your family, all of that, when now you're being asked suddenly to go, I guess for a big chunk of the year, to Atlanta, where your surrogate family now is going to be Jason Bateman, Laura Linney, and all the Langmoors.
That's a really funny sentence. My surrogate father is Jason Bateman. My surrogate mother is adopted mother is Laura Linney, adopted father. Yeah, all that stuff. That's really funny.
Yeah.
Yes, and luckily they're the most wonderful people ever. You know, I talk about amazing, I don't want to use this word, but leaders. I mean, they know how to lead a set because they don't behave like I'm the leader. They just are. They're so good to the crew. They're so good to all the cast. They really care, you know? And, God, I learned so much from that set, you know, and so much from Jason and so much from Laura. I mean, she's just such a natural teacher. So I feel very, very, very lucky that I got to do this job with them and work with them. And I mean, you know, they're both amazing and beautiful people.
Well, one thing that just occurred to me, I didn't even have this written down, but I was thinking, you know, the only times I've really interviewed Laura, I think, were to do with covering Broadway, where she's done a lot of great work. And I wondered if, you know, just speaking with her or observing her career, has that ever kind of planted the seed in your mind that you would like to do some stage work on that level? Is that something that would appeal to you if an offer came?
There, it would. I mean, I don't know if I would ever want to do what she did like a few months ago, the one woman show. I don't know how she did that. And I've never seen anything like it. It was so incredible. But, you know, Laura has definitely given me some of the best advice I've ever received in my career. I mean, she's so generous. And she's just so smart. And Jason is also so generous and so smart and giving me great advice. I mean, they both, I really feel like I have a back with them, you know? It's very nice to feel. It feels nice to feel that you have beyond support, but that back.
So for the record, Julia Garner says that Laura Linney is not a bitch wolf.
Anything but. I felt like I had to apologize to her every 5 minutes in between takes because, like, she's so poised and proper, Laura. So I'm like, I can't believe I'm calling Laura Linney a bitch wolf.
Like, well, did you have you have some great insults on that show. Is there one that is a personal favorite?
Oh, man. I mean, the bitch wolf is great. And then, of course, I feel like a very amazing iconic line is shut your fuck nugget mouth and get the hell out. I mean, that just that, like, oh, and also the Snow White, like season one, there was a couple great ones, like, and I don't see any dwarves running around here, like Snow White, like, I mean, I'm just like, where do you, or I don't know shit about fuck. Like,
Now, are any of these improvised or they're all scripted?
No, they're all. No, Chris Mundy's a genius. I'm not that smart to just come up with that. But I will say, like, you know, if I want to make a scene more intense going into the scene and having Ruth at the get-go be really angry, just always add, what the fuck? Or the fuck? The fuck is all. I don't know if I can curse, but I don't like cursing.
Please.
Yes, but this is Ruth. This is not me.
That's right.
Well, and I also, I will throw in Skinny Bitch is a good one as well. That's a...
Oh, that actually was, like, Jason added that, because there needed to be a line in between, you know, with, that's the wheel... So terrible. The kicking off the boat with the wheelchair, right? That one.
Yeah. Well, I think, though, that what's interesting for people who have never heard you as you and are listening to this, they only know you as Ruth, you know, the contrast is obviously very stark. And I think that in terms of you mentally just getting into the part each time you play it, you know, we've talked about some of the longer term things that you can do with working with your acting coach, journaling, all of that. But I read that for Ruth, maybe specifically, I don't know if this also applies to other characters, there's a certain kind of music that helps you to get into the mindset. Maybe is it before each time you play her in a scene?
Yeah, I definitely think, well, the thing that's a few of the similarities to Ruth and I are definitely we both love 90s hip hop. I grew up with that. So, you know, my dad loves 90s hip hop and my whole family really does. So there's that, but that wasn't, when I got it, I was like, oh, this is not hard. I'll be able, I have all of these songs on my Spotify and iTunes anyway, so, you know, but, so there's that, but, you know, I think a lot of it also has to do, again, you're becoming, I don't want to say creating, but becoming a person, it comes even down to the walk. It comes down to how you carry your body, what is the fidgeting stuff that people have little tics that they do that they don't even notice that they're doing. And even the walk for Ruth is so important. And that was all like an accident in a way, because I had a fitting the first year and the week before we were shooting, and I was putting on these boots and they're like, these boots are great. But the boots were so heavy. And I was like kind of mocking, like, what if I walked like this? I was like, oh, wait, what if I walk? I actually like how this is walking. And there's something about her that's very tomboyish, but almost like she's not a girl's girl. She only knows how to be around men because she didn't grow up with women. And I think she's like secretly kind of upset about that. Like she wishes that she can be a girl's girl, but she's just not. So she walks like a little boy in a way, like, you know, with the shoulders and everything. And and there's a determination, you know?
Absolutely. Well, so what do you make of the evolution of that character over, we're speaking after three seasons, just, you know, season one, as you've said in other things, you know, she was basically a child. Season two, becoming more of a woman, also kind of vulnerable. Is she a bird? Is she a Langmore? Season three, maybe a little bit more vulnerability we see of her. What have you made of the evolution? And has there been one of those seasons where you've felt most challenged or enjoyed it the most? Or just curious as you look back at the whole arc of it all?
I think season one was hard in the sense where I've never played a part like that. I don't have anything similar to Ruth, really. And I was learning how to be on a TV show because, again, things move very differently and faster. And it was very tired because, you know, I had an accent and I was dealing with all these things. And, you know, I had to play up my toughness because I don't feel like I'm, like, the toughest person. So I had to kind of play that up and try to convince people, you know, it's like my job is convincing people that, you know, and then season two was more that, okay, this is the trick. This is the hardest part with that. The key with TV is you want to make the person consistent, but you don't want to make things repetitive. And there's a big difference between that, you know, and it's not a movie. You got to come back and, but how can I make this character and person grow and evolve rather than repeating the same thing? So there's that. And then season three's challenge was because I had a love interest, I didn't just want Ruth to change just because she has, like, a boyfriend, you know? So I had to plan out, like, when I was going to have a wall with Ben and have this wall, and then when was I going, what scene and moment was going to be the moment that I was going to take the wall down and have him actually see me for who I am. Also just, she didn't have a back this season. You know, she lost Wyatt and she lost her whole family, and she's trying to convince herself, you know, absolutely, she did the right thing. Yeah. So.
Well, I'm wondering, I guess, you know, between after your work on season one, that, I don't know if you were already on to the work on season two when season one dropped, but when that moment happened and you're on a show on Netflix, which is going out to basically every country except North Korea, pretty much. And, you know, Emmys really was more second and third season, but just, you know, the show, obviously you're on a major, major show in a big part. When did you feel the impact on your own day-to-day life? Like, all right, I'm going to go to the store or whatever.
I felt it very, very late, to be honest, because I don't read anything about myself ever. Like, I had to read and see, like, I've read maybe only a handful of reviews in my life, but like not a lot. Like, I've maybe read a total of, like, and this is my whole career, okay? Like, mm-hmm. maybe like 6-7 reviews.
Wow. And why is that?
Like, this is my whole career, not just Ozark. Mm-hmm. Because good or bad, it's going to affect you because it's going to get in your head. And I don't mean, like, you know, becoming conceited or whatever, but I mean, it could be that too, but more, I was so, everyone seemed to like me last year or liked my last performance. I hope that I have to keep it up. You know, and it just good or bad, or even if it's like, oh, they really hated it. And then you just get self-conscious, and that's not what acting is about. You're just being present in the moment. And, you know, so I try not, I really like, unless if somebody, if I have 6 different people sending me the same review that they're like, you have to read this. I'm like, okay. So that's normally the case. You know, so I try. I think that's the downfall.
But you can't help if somebody sees you at, you know, a gas station or something and says that, you know, where suddenly, I guess, just in terms of that side of it, where, you know, I remember, I don't know if it was Woody Allen or somebody was saying that a big part of what, I don't think it was Woody Allen. Somebody was saying,
even if, you know, it was. Yeah, it can be any, like, famous person.
Yeah, that they were saying that a big part of what makes you good as an actor in their case, I guess they can't speak for everybody, is being able to observe people behaving normally and processing that and then channeling that into your work. But if people are no longer behaving normally around you, does that make your job as an actor harder?
Yes. Yes and no. But that sounds terrible, but that's not my problem. That's their problem.
Yeah. No, but what I'm saying is, for you, is it harder, though? Because when the other thing that you were talking about, being frozen at whatever age, like, people, I think earlier on, maybe when we were talking about whatever happens to you as a child, that's going to shape who you are as an adult. Another thing I've often heard is, like, in some ways, you're frozen in certain ways at the age when you become a famous person, because life is not going to be the same after that.
For sure. Yeah. But, I think, you know, I've had a lot of, like, I feel like everybody has life lessons in a way. And mm-hmm. I think one of my life lessons is things can change in a flip of a dime in a way. And it's the same with this business, you know. But if you can control your consistency on what you can do as a person or your work that you deliver, if you can be consistent, that's not going to change, you know. Yeah. but other people might not be so that's what I mean. It's like, not that it's like, oh, it's your problem, not mine. I just mean that, like, you have to be consistent if someone else isn't being consistent, in a way,
right?
You know, so yeah. But I will say this, like, I haven't been feeling it as much, like, you know, because I it has changed. I mean, I will say this, as awful as 2020 is, the mask thing, if I wear sunglasses and a hat and a mask, like, it's so great. Like, and here's the thing. It's like, you know, I mean, it's also, it's doing, killing two birds in one stone. You're getting protected and I'm not getting bombarded in a way.
That's right. That's right. Well, and it's not like you've had a lot of time between seasons to just like hang out and party. Let's just note,
first of all, I never did that anyway. Like, I'm like the most boring person. Like, yeah, I don't leave my house. And that was, my life hasn't changed before, after, oh, whatever. Like, I don't leave the house. So that's been consistent.
Well, I will say though, I mean, you had all these three limited series between seasons, I assume, with Waco, Dirty John, and Maniac. And then, of course, I guess another thing that was clearly between seasons, I believe filmed in the spring of 2019, is The Assistant, which I want to, you know, this will be our final chapter here of this conversation. And it's so great. I think that probably the pandemic didn't help, you know, in terms of theatrical release, but it is available now on Hulu and people can go and see it, and they really should. You're playing this recent college graduate now working as an assistant to a high-powered and in some ways abusive movie executive. This is Kitty Green's first narrative film. It's one day in the life of this character you're playing. And to me, it was almost like watching a silent movie because you don't have very many lines of dialogue. I'd love to see what the script looked like because you emote so much through posture and eye flickers and all the other, every other thing but dialogue, except for the scene with the HR guy played by Matthew McFadyen, which is a very powerful scene. But just how did it come about, and what for you was the main appeal of this character?
You know, I think I've seen casting JonBenet the month it went on Netflix, because I love documentaries and I love crime dramas. So, of course, I was going to be the first one seeing that on Netflix. So I've heard about her and I was instantly like a fan of hers. And then when I saw that she was doing a feature with, you know, the first non-documentary film, I was like, oh, I definitely want to do this. But also, adding on to what I was saying earlier, going back, I was looking for something to go back to my indie film roots in a way, and go back to my roots where I started. And, you know, that just felt like the perfect film. And then on top of it, there was something really appealing to me having almost being in like a silent film, you know, and how hard that is. You know, it's equally as hard as having a ton of dialogue in like a courtroom drama that you have to like memorize like this stuff for law stuff. Like it's equally as hard in a way, with an accent. And I've done tons of dialogue with an accent, and that's very hard. But it's equally as hard because one hand you have to translate everything and not speak, but the other hand, you don't want to overact it, you know, because the fact is that Jane, the girl, this is just another day. She's just photocopying. She's not thinking about, she's done this 100 times every day. She's not thinking about like, oh, is he coming? Oh, no, she's just thinking about photocopying, you know, whatever form she's going to photocopy, or, you know, so it's very subtle things. But I think the thing that was the tension was everybody's always watching everyone. And, oh, well, yeah, well, everyone's going to watch me. Like, am I going to photocopy fast enough or this? Or like, you know, no one has each other's back and all that stuff. There's that tension. So that was really appealing to me. But yeah, and also just something was appealing too, that, you know, how I prepared that movie especially was that I really wanted, like, Kitty made it very clear, and I loved that she did that, was she really wanted this movie to be a quiet movie, like, energetically, and just the atmosphere of it. It's like a quiet, silent movie. Because the situation is so loud. So the contrast between that is really interesting. And I wanted to make sure that I was separating the audience with the people who she was in the room with. So you could really separate the two and isolate them. And so the audience is on the journey with Jane, and they really also feel alone and isolated and uncomfortable and actually quite a miserable experience, you know? But I knew this wasn't going to be a popcorn film, but I also knew that way it was important, you know?
Oh, it's really powerful. And I will say, I know that you guys from, I think, the time it premiered in Telluride, where I was there with a lot of people who...
I love that festival. That's honestly the best festival I've ever... I mean, I love all the festivals, but I mean, so special.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's just for movies. Also, Turner Classic Movies reps there too. So it's
totally. Cool. And you know what else is that Laura Linney's husband, I believe she met there.
He's the nicest guy too.
Yeah. And she comes every year, even when she doesn't have sometimes she does have a movie that's playing at the fest, but you should, yeah, come back. Quite a few people go even when they don't have movies.
I know. I was thinking about doing that. I was like, if I'm not shooting that week, if I'm just like not working, and I'm definitely going to do that because it's really special.
Yeah. Well, I will say, you know, one of the things that's nice there is that there's a lot of people from the business. It's not, I know from talking to, you know, actors and people who have been there, that you're not, they're the only people that are going to pay that much and schlep that far to go to a film festival are serious film people. So you're not getting, you can walk around and enjoy movies like everybody else. And, you know, everybody's talking about movies. And among the people who I spoke to a lot at that festival are people who at one time or another worked for Harvey Weinstein. Now, I know you guys have said this is not specifically Harvey Weinstein, but when we are talking, you know, there are so many things that for a lot of these people, I don't know if maybe they said this to you on the gondola or whatever at Telluride, but, you know, the from the looks of The Office in Tribeca to some of the darker stuff that's come out, the literally like penile injection syringes, to stay.
I laugh when things are really terrible. So
yeah, no, it's crazy. But staying at they're reliving their lives because, all right, Harvey when he's coming to LA, he stays at the Peninsula, which you guys talk about. He's going to fly into Van Nuys. He's always a slob, so the desk needs to be cleaned up. Even the voice that we hear behind the door, we never see this guy's face, but it's this gravelly, either he's yelling or laughing or whatever, and it's the gravelly. So, and I can tell you as somebody who, you know, as I, you know, my beat is sort of award season, I've been on both the receiving end of the screaming and the flattering notes like that email your character gets where it's like,
I'm sure I'm you doing have. I'm already thinking, I can't imagine even what emails you've got.
Yeah, no, I mean, luckily he wasn't interested in sexually harassing me, thank God. But I was getting some weird stuff from this guy and it just was very eerie. I think you guys nailed it. I get it if you can't say, or if you don't, maybe there are elements that aren't specifically Harvey, but just the idea that you're, as someone who's kind of risen to prominence in the era when this has all gone down, the whole fall of him, the Me Too movement, you probably even know and have worked with people who have, and God forbid, I hope not, but may have experienced it yourself. I guess on that meta level, what's it like to be telling that kind of a story about the business that we're all actually in?
Well, I first of all, I want to start that I've been very fortunate that I've worked with really kind, wonderful people. Again, I told you Laura and Jason are great leaders and they don't abuse their power. But, you know, and I've never had any sort of sexual harassment. I've definitely know people who have and who have experienced it, but I've been very lucky that I haven't. But I will say, you know, the thing that I love about the assistant is that it's not from the point of view of the person who's getting sexually abused or who is the abuser or who's this. Like, it's the person outside. It is the person who is saying yes to all of the abuser's requests or whatever, the higher up. Because it's so much bigger than just like, that man is an abuser. He needs to be like done and finished with. It's like, yes, absolutely. That's stating the obvious. But the bigger question is, and the bigger subject is who are the yes people? Who are, and I'm not saying it's Jane's fault. It's really the fault of the people, the executives at the company that work for him that are too afraid to, you know, push his comfort zone. Like, hey, you can't do this. Who he actually listens to. But they're too afraid to even say. So they're yes people in a way. Okay, we're enabling this behavior because we're afraid of him. So it is the abuser, but it's also the people who are enabling this kind of behavior, and they're also shaping the environment. You know, it's not just when people are like, oh yeah, I've worked, you know, I just said it. I worked with amazing people. I didn't say I work with an amazing person.
Right.
You
right,
know?
Right.
So it's that to me is what I love about this movie.
No, it's really, really well done. And I think even that scene in the elevator, mute this, folks, for 30 seconds if you haven't seen the movie, but basically where the female exec is like, don't worry, honey, you know, they're getting more out of it than he ever will or whatever. Like, clearly those people existed, and it's tough because...
Yeah, and it's also powerful, you know, that a female executive is saying that too.
It's such a... The whole thing is really twisted because even in reality, with Harvey specifically, he, on some level, really did respect women. Like, all his top PR people and awards people and certain other execs he had a president product, they were women. So he, and yet obviously there's this flip side of it where who knows psychologically what made it happen, but and clearly a lot of people had to know some degree of what was going on. Maybe they didn't know the whole picture, but it does make all of us, I think back
more
to
that.
They
were in denial of the whole picture and they weren't really addressing it, or they had a feeling, but they weren't looking into it. They weren't listening to their gut.
Absolutely. All right. So with our last minute, I hope I can just give you like your gut response to a few different quick things. First of all, what do you think happens to Jane after the credits roll?
I think she goes back to work right away.
And stays there and becomes the producer that she wants to be? Or what happens?
I think she, I think so. But maybe she goes back to work and probably she works somewhere else after a year or two. That's just like the truth of the project. Like, I was never going to be like, oh yeah, she's definitely like being like peace. No, because who knows, they could be calling five other companies and be like, don't hire this girl. This girl's crazy. So,
and I think that did happen. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And I think, you know, it was interesting. Like, not that I got, people were like, why didn't she just quit? I'm like, how many times did you experience an abusive, and you did not say anything because you're in such shock? Like, before right. you judge, just reflect back of different situations that you've been in. And it's always a what if question, but sometimes it's not reality, you know?
Yeah.
Number two of these four rapid fires. I believe that when this frickin' pandemic ends, we will next see you in Shonda Rhimes' first Netflix show. I think it's a limited series called Inventing Anna. And anyone who's read that article, was it New York Magazine or which magazine?
Yeah,
was it about?
Yeah, it was a cut article, which is New York.
Yeah.
New York, yeah.
So just this, I'm not even going to try to synopsize, just one of the craziest stories. I think in our own recent cover story about you, visited Anna Delvey, who you're playing, and in jail where she is at the moment. Is that, that's got to be one of the more surreal things as an actress that you've had to deal with?
Yeah, it got super meta at one point because she asked me how she's, I don't want to do the act, but she's like, how are you playing me? And I don't want to do it too much because you guys have to see, I mean, and her accent, and I, you know, I was, you know, telling her how I'm, you know, I want people to see her as a person rather than a character because I feel like, you know, the public has, you know, she hasn't really had any interviews in a way. And I want people to understand her story. That's my job as an actor, for people to understand why that person did that. So, and then she said, and I said, and your accent's really hard. And she's like, how do you sound like me? and then I said, I don't know. She's like, nah, do it. And I mean, she taught, and it's this weird German, Russian, but has American tones to it. Like the music of how she speaks sounds like an American almost because she's been here for a while. And then we were just talking like each other and it got really meta.
That's great. I can't wait to see that. It's three of four is, have you spoken with Madonna?
No.
Never?
Mm-mm.
Okay. And finally.
I'm like, where are you hearing that, Scott? Are you just on the internet? No. I'm a very big fan of hers, though. So, no. But, yes, that's... I don't really know how to answer that question, but no, I haven't spoke to her or met her. So
we're not ruling out written correspondence. Okay.
Like, is she with you right now?
Okay. Number four. And finally, I mean, it's amazing. You're 26.
Wow. Six. I had to think about that for a sec. That's my mindset in 2020 that I'm just like, what day is it? How old am I? Am I a boy? Well, am I a boy? What am I?
I only bring it up. I know it's not always polite to talk about age, but I bring it up because
it's okay. Because this is the thing. It's a fact. I am 26. It's whatever.
And by the way, that's you're so young, and I just
I'm taking that so you can say that I'm 26. Thank you.
I mention it only because it's unbelievable. As people who have listened to this point in the conversation, you know, there's a lot that's been accomplished already. We didn't even talk about the fact that, I guess we mentioned it briefly at the beginning, you know, two Emmys by 26 is pretty rare and incredible. Two Emmys at any ages, and just all the work. So I guess my final question is, what is most high on the bucket list moving forward? So what haven't you been able to do yet that you most would like to do? Is it one of those things that people, their lack of imagination prevented you from doing when you were first auditioning, like a rom-com or something like you were talking about earlier, or is it, you know, just continue on the same track or something in between?
Definitely a rom-com, a good, like, I'm talking about like a Moonstruck type of thing.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
I love that movie and Harry Met Sally and all those amazing rom-coms. So that for sure. But, you know, I like doing things where I'm even surprising myself. So I don't know quite what it is yet, but when I see it and in front of me, I'll know. And it's kind of one of those things like, I can't do this. This is impossible. I can't do this. Okay, I'm going to do it. Like, that's how I always, every character that, like Ruth, Anna, Eve, I mean, hopefully it's, I'm going to do a good job and people are going to like it. But, you know, anything where I'm like, this is impossible. No, I can't. I'm going to do this. Let me just call them my agents and be like, yep.
Well, that is exciting for all of us. And so nice to meet you. And I look forward to our AFI thing. And
yeah,
thank
and
you for doing this.
Ride one, when this is all over.
Please, God, I can't wait to get back there. I mean, this year was put off, canceled or whatever, but it's going to be a fun thing in 2021. You got to make it happen. Move the schedule around. You got to be there.
I know. I will. Thank you so much, Scott. This is,
yeah,
I'm
my
such
pleasure.
A fan. Thank you.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your podcast app and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/Scott Feinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/the race. Until next time, thanks for joining us.